Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Mount Clemens, Michigan, and earned a doctorate in health sciences from Indiana University. For 50-plus years, we've heard him broadcast baseball, football, golf, tennis, the Olympics, horse racing, boxing, track and field, and figure skating. The winner of 14 Sports Emmy Awards, he's been the Sportscaster of the Year 5 times. Famous for his signature catchphrase, "Oh my." His name, Dick Enberg. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to an American legend, Dick Enberg. Dick, welcome back. It's an honor to have you.
Well, the great voice of the Great Lakes. I grew up 40 miles north of Detroit, and that was our radio home on the farm in Armada, Michigan. And if you wanted to be a part of the occasion, you tuned in to WJR.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Well, I was born in Mount Clemens, which is about 14, 15 minutes or miles north of Detroit. My dad and mother moved before World War II to California, where he worked in a defense plant. And after the war, came back to visit relatives, and my dad bought an apple orchard, a fruit orchard in Armada, Michigan, on 33 Mile Road. And I grew up there, went to a one-room school in the 7th and 8th grade, and then moved into the big time. Armada High School graduating class of 1952 had all of 32 and me. And it was a Spartan kind of life, but we didn't know we were poor, and we enjoyed the small pleasures whenever they arrived. Eventually, I got a scholarship to Central Michigan, a $100 academic scholarship to Central Michigan, and I thought, goodness, if they're going to pay you to go to college, I better take this on. And I got out my suitcase and my right thumb and hitchhiked to Mount Pleasant, Michigan, and that's where my academic career started seriously, and it took me all the way to a doctorate at Indiana University.
Recently, they did a statue of you, unveiled it a couple of months ago. What was that like going back to CMU and you and your wife seeing this, being honored and seeing this statue unveiled?
Well, I'm a pretty humble guy, and first it was a bit embarrassing, a little over the top. And a friend of mine who also went to Central Michigan and lives in San Diego, Todd Anson, grew up in Mount Pleasant, and he attended Central Michigan as well. And when he was younger, he's younger than I am by 20 years, he said as a kid, he was in a conversation about who were the top sportscasters or who was the favorite sportscaster. And my name came up, and someone said, well, you know, he went to school right here in Mount Pleasant at Central Michigan. And Todd said, oh, come on, Dick Enberg didn't go to Central Michigan. Of course, at the time I attended there, Central Michigan was a teacher's college. I was a student body president. There was maybe 4,500 students at the time in 1957. Now it's grown, and they just announced it's going to have a medical school, which is a wonderful thing. Anyway, he said, there ought to be some remembrance of Enberg to let people know that when they come to Central Michigan, we all have a chance. You know, here's a guy that was a total nothing and became somebody because of the education at this institution. So he donated a significant sum so that an outstanding sculptor could do a bust of me. And with the marble base, it's about my height. And it greets the students and fans as they enter the basketball arena on campus at Central Michigan. And that was his purpose. And hopefully young kids will see that as an inspiration. The sculptor decided to have a microphone in one hand and my thumb up as if to say, way to go, thumbs up, which was part of a photograph that he had found when I gave the commencement address at Central Michigan many years ago, 32 years ago. And I hope that the kids, when they come in, will rub the thumb, and maybe that'll be good luck. I hope when I go back there 10 years from now that thumb is all shiny, and that my favorite institution, Central Michigan, will have many winning seasons.
After you got a doctorate from Indiana, it's 1966, and you get hired to do men's basketball play-by-play for the UCLA Bruins. Talk about that journey.
Well, I did the Bruins for 9 years, and of course, John Wooden, I rode that wooden wave in 9 years. The UCLA team won 8 national championships, so I was a pretty good announcer. The timing was perfect. They had decided, Channel 5 in Los Angeles, owned by Gene Autry, had hired me. I left the Cal State Northridge, where I was teaching and coaching baseball, and they acquired the rights to the UCLA games, and the first telecast was the first game played by a big guy from New York, Lou Alcindor, Kareem Jabbar. And in the next 9 years, I did their telecast home and away, solo. I flew solo. There was no color man in those days. And they win 8 national championships. So because of their success, my work calling their games became more not just local, but regional, and eventually nationally some of the games would be shown. And I guess that's how the world was introduced to Dick Enberg, the broadcaster, and I'm forever grateful not only for that opportunity and the good fortune to be in the right place at the right time, but in those years to rub shoulders with the greatest man I've ever known other than my own father, and that's John Robert Wooden. You know, God doesn't make anyone perfect, but he came mighty close when he brought John Wooden to this world.
Tell us one story about Coach Wooden, if you would.
Well, there were a lot. You know, he had a very simplistic way of coaching. I mean, he started with all the basics, including spending a whole day of practice in the early season just to show his players how to put on their socks and tie their shoes so that they didn't get blisters. Bill Walton kiddingly says, you know, I couldn't wait after my freshman year to be eligible as a sophomore and for the great John Wooden and the defending national champions, and I was all fired up, and the first practice, there I am in the locker room trying to tie my shoes to the satisfaction of the head coach. There was one incident. We were UCLA was playing a weekend series in the Northwest. It was Washington on a Saturday and Washington State on a Monday. So on Sunday after the game, on Saturday night in Washington, they flew to Spokane and then took it's about a 2-hour bus ride from Spokane out to the beautiful Palouse country to Washington State, which is really right on the Idaho border. And in that 2-hour drive, I'm sitting in the back of the bus, and the student manager comes back and says, Coach Wooden would like you to come up and sit with him. And my eyes brighten. I thought, here I am. I'm going to be able to sit in, locked in with Coach Wooden for a couple of hours. I'm going to get so much material. That Monday night telecast from Washington State may be the best I'll ever do. So I go up and sit next to Coach, and the first thing he says to Enberg, do you like poetry? And I said, what am I going to say? Yeah, Coach, yeah, I love poetry. He says, hey, how about St. Vincent Millay? Well, yeah, Coach, yeah, one of my favorites. And I'm just trying to go along with the program till we get to basketball. And we spent the entire 2 hours talking about everything but basketball, starting with poetry and religion, the fact that he is an Abraham Lincoln scholar, his days as a baseball player. That was his favorite sport. So I didn't get the information that I wanted for the basketball game on Monday night, but it was an introduction to Wooden and why he was such an incredible coach, because he was such a well-rounded man.
We're talking to Dick Enberg. When we come back, we'll ask him about a wonderful friend he's had since 1957. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Crisula, and we're with the legendary Dick Enberg. Dick, oh my, you've had it since 57. How did that come about?
Well, Jack, the Midwesterners, it's an expression, as we all know, of acclimation. that two women are in the market line, and one says to the other, "Did you hear about the Jones boy?" And the other says, "Oh, my." Or two guys are talking about the high school game on Friday night, and some kid scored 30 points, and, "Oh, my, what a game that was." Well, I wander from Central Michigan with my undergraduate degree and earned a graduate assistantship at Indiana University in 1957. And the first day I'm on campus, I'd never been to Indiana, by the way, I'm walking, trying to familiarize myself with the layout of the campus, and I go by the little radio center there that was really a Quonset hut, and there's a sign on the door saying, "Auditions next Monday for the new Indiana University Sports Network." At the time, Indiana didn't have one. They just had local broadcasts of their games, and a new professor from Iowa had come in. Dick Yoakum became my mentor. Said, "This is ridiculous. You're a Big Ten team. You've got to have a network." And so he formed one, and I was first in line for the audition and won that audition. Phil Jones, who for 30 years was a very successful White House correspondent for CBS News, was my color man. We had eight stations that first year, and it grew in my 4 years there, earning my graduate degrees, to 40. So it was really a very successful enterprise, and I was fortunate to have won that audition and start things off. So I'm doing Big Ten football and basketball now, and as a young kid, you're listening to all the great broadcasters from Red Barber to Mel Allen to Van Patrick and Detroit and on and on. All of them, Harry Carey, they all had a little punctuation mark, a little exclamation point to a great play, and I said, "Well, I've got to come up with one." And so I decided that since a lot of the holies had been taken, Holy Toledo and Holy Cow and all the rest, and Allen's, "Well, how about that?" And I guess Van Patrick, I don't think he really had a signature phrase, but he was such a tremendous voice and announcer there at JR. So I tried "Oh My," and the first game I used it for a couple of high moments, and of course it has a complete usage because it can be used in an exciting moment as well as a very disappointing moment or a surprising moment. And about 3 weeks into the football season, a couple of guys in the graduate dormitory saw me and they said, "Hey, Edinburgh, oh my." And I thought, well, that's it. And it's been my friend and pal since 1957. I try not to overuse it, but when I can't think in a great moment of anything else to say, "Oh my," covers a lot of bases.
We're talking to Dick Edinburgh, who's won 14 sports Emmys. 5 times he's been the Sportscaster of the Year, and he has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Dick, you've also done 28 fortnights at Wimbledon. What makes Wimbledon so special?
It's probably the most complete sports event of all those that I've covered. I don't think I can put Olympics in that category because that's a totally different creature. But for an annual event, let's look at it this way. If you do a World Series, that's 7 games maybe, or a Stanley Cup playoff, 7, or the March Madness. You have the Saturday semis and the Monday final. That's a great, great weekend. But Wimbledon is more than that. It's 2 weeks, and it's the one event that is most historic. It's the event that every player that picks up a racket knows that if they win Wimbledon, they'll secure their place in that sport's history. And so the meaningfulness of that event, and then to sit in that ancient center court that is really the cathedral of tennis, playing on grass, which makes it all the more special. The fact that the British themselves, for 2 weeks, they really shut things down and embrace this event. It's their summer picnic. It just has all the elements, and then London in the background and all that great city has to offer as well. And you start in that first day, and 128 men and women, and you reduce it, as any tournament does, and it's almost like an election. By the time you get to the second week, there's 16 left, and who's going to prevail out of those top 16 players as you build in them? You know, that's part of it, the dramatic build toward the climax. And then finally to see the champion of Wimbledon, man and woman in singles, raise their trophies. It's of all the things I've done, it's the single event that I've enjoyed most of all. It's not the best sport to call. Baseball is the best sport of all, but the Wimbledon has been a wonderful event. I'm going to miss not doing it.
For 50 years, 50-plus years, we've heard you broadcast baseball, football, golf, tennis, the Olympics, horse racing, boxing, track and field, figure skating. You're the most versatile sports announcer of all time, and we've listened to you call 10 Super Bowls. Talk about those experiences.
Well, it's madness, just as the players and coaches would attest. There's so much coverage now. It has become a circus, and you can't wait even as a broadcaster for that week of preparation and publicity and parties and phone calls and interviews and on for the game to start so that you can ease back into your routine. And the players have all and coaches have all said the very same thing. They finally, the kickoff, and we can do what we enjoy doing most of all. But you don't cover the game any differently than any other. It's just that you have much more information, and you have to be careful about not inundating your audience early with all the things you know. I mean, you're only going to be on the air 3 hours, and you probably have 30 hours of prepared material that is pertinent to that game and those two teams and the players and coaches. So it's trying to rein yourself back and not overwork the game. And I was taught a very good lesson. I think it was 1983. The game, Super Bowl, was at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena. It was the Miami Washington Redskins game. It was the John Riggins, the Rigonomics game, where he ran for the winning touchdown late in the fourth quarter. In the first quarter, what fans can't appreciate but next time you listen to or watch the Rose Bowl, you'll know. In this case, Jim Nantz at CBS or Buck at Fox or whoever might be doing the game. The starting lineups for the Super Bowl are done simultaneously on television and on the PA system. They hook the two together so that your voice, in this case my voice, is introducing the starting lineups to the Rose Bowl at the same time to the television audience. So we do that, and we break for commercial and come back. I was working with Merlin Olsen at the time. We come back, and something's gone wrong. There's a two-second delay in our headsets. So by the time you say it's first and 10 at the 30, when you say 30, you're hearing first and 10. And it was maddening. I mean, it was as if someone had sabotaged the broadcast. What are they doing to us? Here's the most important game of the year, and we can't even do our work. We're working in this sound tunnel that is betraying us. And what Merlin and I finally learned quickly was that we couldn't talk in any long sentences. We had to say something quickly and pause, let the echo go by, and then come back and start again. Well, I was furious, and at the first time out, I'm saying, come on, you guys, you got to fix this up. Do you realize what this is? I mean, we can't do the job. And it goes another whole commercial, another almost to the end of the first quarter before they fix it. Well, afterwards, I was disgusted, mad. I couldn't wait to get out of the Rose Bowl, get home. It's the worst broadcast I've ever had. Friends were there. We had a party after the game. And when I got there, they said, hey, great telecast. What a game. And I said, oh, it's the worst thing I've ever done. And they said, no, look, we taped it. Let's look at the first quarter. And after explaining to all of them what had happened, I listened to the first quarter. And I thought, wow, this is good. And it taught me that we don't have to overtalk. And because of the situation, we were concise. We didn't smother the audience with a lot of the information that we had at hand. And it allowed the audience to ease its way into the game. And then when it was finally corrected, we could be more verbal and give the other information. Good lesson to learn. And in fact, I just gave a lecture at Marquette University on the power of silence, the power of the pause. In our broadcasting business or in life and business, there's really something very powerful about the pause. And it brings people in, it emphasizes the point, and in this case, in the Rose Bowl, in a Super Bowl, I learned that lesson.
Oh my. We're talking to Dick Enbrecht. When we come back, we'll ask him about his football broadcasting partner, the late, great Merlin Olsen. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, and we're talking to Dick Enberg, the author of Humorous Quotes for All Occasions and Oh My. Dick, you were blessed to be around Merlin Olsen.
Well, Merlin was the ultimate student athlete. He was an All-America at Utah State. He was almost a four-point student. I'm very proud of the fact that for 25 years now, I've been the spokesperson for the Academic All-America Hall of Fame program. It's one of the most exciting things that I do, and it's because I meet some of the very special people on college and university campuses. And then after their academic life is over, they go out and what they have accomplished in their social life and giving back to society. And Merlin was in the charter class of that Academic All-America Hall of Fame, and to work side by side with him was something very special. And it was, you know, we were the first, it was my first partner on the NFL. I had worked about a dozen years as the Rams announcer with Dick Bass, and actually Don Drysdale, who was my baseball partner, was also my partner in football with the Rams. But then comes Merlin Olsen. He was, of course, the star player, defensive lineman with the Rams when I was calling their games. And then, as fate would have it, as we both wander away from local television and radio to the networks and to NBC at the time, that they put the two of us together. Merlin brought that same academic student approach to the broadcast booth. He would take big yellow legal pages, papers, and for every telecast, he would have 30, 40 items on there that he would say, okay, Dick, here's some things I've been thinking about the game. You could ask me questions about any one of these items, and if we're in a lull in the game or it fits perfectly into a situation, you can ask me about it, and I've got some good stories to tell. He'd do the same thing for the producer. Here's some things, some shots that I think that would... Same thing for the director. You know, I might be talking about this, and here are 30, 40 things that you might... shots that you might want to get for us. I mean, he was amazing. I pride myself in the fact that I would take a test with any broadcaster in all my 50-plus years in terms of the effort in preparing for a telecast. It's like preparing for a lecture when I was a college professor. And I don't think there's anyone that has outworked me, but boy, Merlin Olsen did. I mean, he just was such a student of the game. And so what a privilege to be in a broadcast booth with someone so well-informed, so well-prepared, that there was nothing you could throw at him that he wouldn't be able to handle brilliantly, and died much too soon a couple of years ago. I'm saddened by the fact that he's still not with us, because everything that he did with excellence, whether it was an actor or whether it was as a broadcaster or as a businessman. And you know, he defined the Greek ideal of a sound mind and a sound body. That was Merlin Olsen.
In the last segment, you mentioned Marquette. And a few years ago, you penned a one-man theatrical play entitled Coach as a tribute to your NCAA basketball TV broadcast partner, L. McGuire. Talk about L. McGuire.
Well, I'm not sure the program's long enough, Jack. he was the most incredible person I've ever met. No one in second place. He was a street genius. And while we worked together in basketball with Billy Packer, and then when Packer went to CBS and Al and I were the two-man team with NBC, there were idle times, down times, where he would take time to teach me life. He saw life so differently than anyone I've ever known. He was a New York guy, and he didn't trust, and he was seeing things beyond the obvious, where I'm a farm kid from Armada, Michigan. I trust everybody. He called me Dixie. He would take me by the hand. Dixie, better watch out. Somebody's going to have their hand on your wallet. And I said, yeah, I'll probably you. When he died, the friends of the family asked me to write a page for the memorial program. And I struggled over that. There wasn't much time to do it. And how do you just limit Al McGuire to one page? And I finally decided to just say, hey, let Al write his own page of memorial remembrances. And so I just used his Maguire-isms, you know, taking a right-hand turn in life. If a guy brings flowers home for no reason, there's a reason. You know, and why do the largest American flags fly over foreign car dealerships? And why did kamikaze pilots wear a helmet? You know, he just had this great fund of seeing life so differently from a different angle. And so when after doing that, I started to write down more in detail some of the things that he had taught me. And the more I wrote, the more I remembered. And I'd be up sometimes 3 o'clock in the morning because one just perpetuated the remembrance of another. And when I finally collected all of these memories, I thought, you know what, there's something more here. There's a time when he coached and how he recruited and how he worked officials and how he coached a game, prepared for a game. He wasn't an X's and O's coach. He was he was the MC. He ran the show. And then there was the transition to becoming a broadcaster where he had no idea he never did figure out television. And that's why he trusted me, because he knew that I could lead him through that without any problems. And then even in death, he was of such great wisdom. I'll share one of the things that I put in the play. And in fact, the play just, we did 4 shows in Wisconsin last month. In fact, one was on the exact date that Maguire and Marquette won the 1977 championship. What an event that was. Anyway, he comes back to life, and that pleases me. And the story I included in the play, as he's dying, he says, you know, you got to remember, gang, that when people are old, they don't want flowers. They don't want candy. They don't want a new sweater. They want time. And he tells the story about how he'd go when his mother was dying, and he'd go and sit in their little apartment and on the edge of her bed, and she'd start talking, and he would listen, and then he would ease over into the chair. He said, sometimes I'd fall asleep, and when I woke up, she'd still be talking. And I wasn't being rude. I was giving her what she wanted. I was giving my aging mother time. And it's one of the many beautiful lessons that I learned from Al and that I've included in this play.
You have announced 7 masters. What makes the masters so special?
Well, I never had a chance to actually call as the lead announcer the Masters, but it's much like Wimbledon. I guess the best way to answer that is that those two events are quite similar in that it's the same place at the same time. You know, all the other major events in golf are shared by different courses around the country or the world, whereas the Masters is always there at beautiful Augusta. And the same as Wimbledon and the village outside of London. And I think that many of the golfers would say that it's their favorite event, and it's become, because of the consistency each year of watching these great players on the same course, and anyone who plays golf or loves golf, they get to know the course. And so when they see a great shot made at 16, they can relate to other great moments at that hole. So, and it's the reverence that with which the Augusta National people treat it as well. Just like London, there's rules and regulations, and they tie into the tradition and the history of the event. We've kind of let that get away in our modern world, where there's so much bombarding us, high tech and all the rest. And it's nice to be able to settle into something, a comfortable seat at an event such as Wimbledon or the Masters, where you have a feeling you're not only watching today's tournament, but you're watching another little piece of history.
We're talking to Dick Enberg, who's the only sportscaster to win Emmys in 3 categories: broadcasting, writing, and producing. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the most versatile sports announcer of all time, oh my, Dickin. Dick, you've just started your 3rd season announcing San Diego Padres baseball. You're 77 years old. You got tremendous enthusiasm. How do you stay so young?
Well, it's true of anyone that has passion for life and passion for a sport. And baseball was always my favorite sport. Al Kaline took my position. I was going to be the right fielder of the Tigers, you know. And when I was 18, he was 18, and he came out of Baltimore and took my job. I'll be doggone. And he could hit the ball a bit better and throw from right field. Anyway, I just think that it's I'm a fan, and I call a game as a fan. I prepare and care about my reportage so that the fans will appreciate it, as do I. And I love the title of your show, Anything is Possible, because that could be the title of my next book, because anything is possible. If you're passionate and you care about what you're doing, and you prepare for it, and you study, and then you might find that there'll be opportunity, and then the opportunity allows you to express that love. And that's been the way, you know, I'm lucky enough to sit next to a star, a Hall of Famer, every time I go on the air throughout my career. How great is that? I mean, I sit in one of the best seats of the house. How terrific is that? And I get it checked afterwards. That's really good, too.
And free food.
That's right. And if it's free, you know, in broadcasting, the credo is, if it's free, take three.
Which Major League park has the best food spread?
The best food was in Minneapolis at the old Erectors set, their municipal stadium in Bloomington. It wasn't professionally done. It was local fans, women who came in and brought their best dishes. And that was great eating.
You are extremely grateful and humble, Mr. Enberg. Talk about being grateful and humble.
Well, I had parents that taught me those lessons. In my book, I relate an incident with my father. My mother and father were divorced, and we were on the farm with my dad. And I was a senior in high school, and I played center at 5'11 and a half. That accounts for the misplaced nose that I have. I fouled out of every game, and we won only a couple the entire season, but we did win a game. My dad always went to the games, and I had scored over 20 points and came home, and he was upstairs in the farmhouse in bed. I came in, and I said, "Hey, finally you won one, huh, Dad?" And he said, "Yeah, it's about time you won a game." And I was kind of keeping the conversation going, milking it, hoping that I would finally get some praise from my dad. He wasn't quick with that at all. Very rarely, if at all, did I get that. And I finally said, "I don't know if you're keeping score, Pops, but I think I had 22. And he said, "Yeah, you did have 22, and your man had 25. And I said, "It's really going to kill you, isn't it, someday to say something nice about me?" And he grabbed me by the shoulder, and he said, "Son, the day you think you're so good you can't improve, you can only go one way, and that's down." And he pushed me off his bed. I went to my room, and I didn't think very good things about my dad that night. But that was when I was 17 years old, and here I am 60 years later, and that still lives within me, that if you think you're so good you can't improve, you can only go one way.
Mr. Enberg, in 1997, they named an award after you, the Dick Enberg Award. You won it the first year. Other winners, Dean Smith, Bill Russell, Ellen Page, Tom Osborne, Father Ted Hesburgh, President Gerald Ford, Pat Summitt. What is that like to have?
There are honors and privileges and awards, but none like this one. I mean, to think that it's part of the Academic All-America program, and they decided, it was a total surprise, a wonderful surprise, that they would have an additional award along with the Hall of Fame inductees that would symbolize my passion and devotion to athletics and academics. And so it allowed us to name anyone. And there's a blue ribbon panel that votes for that person. And I have the strongest say, as you might imagine. In fact, this year, this summer, the award will be given to the Paterno family. Joe Paterno was named a year ago, but he couldn't accept. So he said, I tell you what, I'll clear my calendar for 2012 and accept it then. And, of course, under the circumstances, the family and that Joe will be in St. Louis to accept that award. But to think that, I mean, how does it figure that this little kid that grew up at a farm in Michigan has an award that is accepted by the kinds of people that you've just named? It sticks in my throat, the very thought that a President Ford or Dean Smith or a Pat Summitt or this year a Joe Paterno would accept a Dick Enberg Award. I mean, it's the highest honor I've ever received.
As our time winds down together, what advice would you give to our young listeners, Dick Enberg?
Well, the advice I would give is what I taught in a classroom a couple of weeks ago at Marquette after my lecture. Here's what I told them. I said that, and it comes from Al McGuire. Al McGuire used to take a right-hand turn. Once a month, he allowed himself, instead of going to work unannounced, wouldn't call into Marquette, he would take a right-hand turn, which meant instead of left into Milwaukee, a right took you out into the beautiful countryside outside of Milwaukee. And he wouldn't call. That would ruin the spirit. And he would just let life come to him. And the beauty of an unplanned day can be really something wonderfully surprising. And I said today to the kids, I'm concerned that they walk with their heads down. They've got the earphones on, or they're texting, or they're on the Internet, and they don't take time to look up. I said to the classroom, do you know what color the eyes are of your best friend or your girlfriend? What color are their eyes? Have you ever really looked at their eyes? Have you ever really stopped and enjoyed a sunset or a rainbow? Why don't you take a right-hand turn? You don't have to do it as Al McGuire did and take a day off. Maybe set aside a Saturday, 1 hour on a Saturday, where you don't use your earphones, you don't go on the computer, you don't text, and you just walk through your beautiful campus and appreciate it for its beauty and see and smell and feel where you're living. And I'm concerned that our young people aren't doing enough of that. So that would be my advice. Take the Al McGuire version of a right-hand turn and unplug all the technical material that is driving, and it's good, driving so many of you, and just appreciate life itself.
What a right-hand turn this has been, Mr. Enberg. You're an American treasure. Thanks much for all you do. God bless.
Thank you, Jack. Go on by.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoon. It looks like you're the only believer around.